Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. We are Catholic Radio for the Christian community. Good morning and welcome back to Spirit Mornings with Bruce McGregor and
Chris McGregor.
And Chris, we warned her that we'd be back with your pilgrimage to France imminent here in October, talking about Elizabeth Ficicelli. Elizabeth is the author of many books, including The Fruits of Medjugorje and The Imitation of Christ for Children, as well as best-selling titles in the Child's Guide series, all of those from Paulus Press. Of course, we first met Elizabeth and chatted with her about her book, Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity. And we're going to bring Elizabeth back today to talk about St. Bernadette Subaru. Elizabeth, good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Bruce and Chris. Great to be back.
It is such a blessing for us to have you back, Elizabeth. And I just have to say for many of our listeners, they probably, yes, this is the Elizabeth Ficicelli who you saw on Father Benedict Groeschel's show, Sunday Night Live. That must have been a great experience.
It was. It was my very first television experience. So it was a little challenging, you know. You don't have the comfort of radio where you could be in your pajamas when you're interviewed, you know. But it was a lot of fun and certainly helped give exposure to the book and the story of Lourdes.
It is probably one of the best, if not the best, book on what it is to pilgrim and to allow Lourdes to become a part of your life. It is just such a beautifully done book. Just hats off to you, Elizabeth.
Thank you. Thank you. And it's, you know, not meant to be the all-encompassing book on Lourdes, but to give certainly enough information from the past, the present, and where it's going in the future, so that people can delve into it more deeply and certainly get more out of their pilgrimage when they do go.
When we talk about Lourdes, it's very difficult not to mention the young girl who really, this feast day that we celebrate today, who would have thought someone as simple as Bernadette would one day be connected with such a beautiful experience of the Church?
I know, and, you know, this is so typical, I think, of God. He does choose the ordinary. He chooses the unlikely. I see that plenty in my own life. So she is such a good role model, and I think that the thing I'm so glad that you're calling about today is that I think beyond the apparitions, the story of the apparitions, a lot of people don't know what happened after and the deep spirituality and the real reason that she rose to sainthood. You know, it's all the stuff that took place after the apparition. So I'm really anxious to start chatting about that part today.
Well, let's talk about Bernadette. Where did she come from?
Well, you know, I think Bernadette has a lot to accredit at the time the apparition starts, because she is a person who has so much suffering in her life that could, in every sense, make her bitter, and it doesn't. You know, everything from chronic health issues and poverty and her illiteracy and her frustrated attempts to try to receive Holy Communion, you know, but she can't achieve that because she can't master the catechism. And all of these things certainly could make a person bitter, and despite all of this, Bernadette is a very cheerful child, a very happy soul. And when she begins to have these apparitions and sees the Blessed Mother, she reaches her peak in happiness. And, you know, she describes how this lady looks so beautiful. But when the lady begins talking about sins and sinners of the world, this is when the lady grows very somber. And Bernadette is so affected by this change in the lady that she's very eager to accept the role of doing prayer and penance for sinners in the world. And this will become her whole mission in life. She willingly takes this on because she will do anything to make that lady smile again and bring that smile of beauty back on this lady's face. And she starts out right away on this mission. The first thing is, while she's still living at home in the public, you know, where the apparitions have just ended, her house is always inundated with visitors, and they want to touch her and speak to her and have her bless objects. And she's very infringed upon, and they want to, in their best efforts, these people give her food and give her money because she's living in such dire poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Bernadette will not accept any of this because she realizes that her life of poverty is something that she can offer as a penance for sinners, and she's firm in this mission right from the get-go. So we see that as one of the first things in her. We also see when the parish priest moves her to the hospice, which is a place where the Sisters of Nevers work, and it's kind of to get her out of this public vulnerability, if you will. She begins to see a calling to serving the sick and the poor, you know, because it was pretty typical for visionaries in those days to become a religious. That was a typical role, and she was discerning that, you know, as soon as that time. And her first choice would have been to live a contemplative life like a Carmelite, but her poor health wouldn't allow her to take on such rigorous fasting and discipline that they had in their orders. And as she's working and serving and living in this hospice, she sees a calling to this life of serving the poor and the sick. And this is a new thing that begins to unfold in her life. And we see her natural caregiving and her real concern with others. And then it deepens from there, because next thing, then she'll discern a calling to this order, and she goes then on to the mother house in the Vares.
It is quite a dramatic life that she had, even one that I don't think was really captured in Song of Bernadette. A lot of people, when they think of her, Elizabeth, they think of that beautiful movie. And yes, Jennifer Jones did a wonderful job portraying that particular character. But in the movie, I kept seeing this girl who was almost, a victim. I mean, it just seems as though everybody's moving her here and moving her there and making her decisions for her. And yet, Bernadette was so much stronger than that, wasn't she?
She was. Everything she did deliberately. You know, she did with reason. She was not at all a victim. And I think it's an unfortunate way that people do see it, but certainly with that movie, it has been a little bit misplaced. I think a better movie is The Passion of Bernadette.
Which
really goes into these subjects. But everything she does, and you really see it really come out in her life in the convent then in the Vares. First of all, you know, you have to kind of remember that Bernadette was this girl from the mountains. She was spontaneous and outgoing. She had a very strong will. She had a sense of humor. And when she moves into the convent, and she's living at a time where there's very strict regulations, obedience, mortification, and her whole existence in this convent, she's always running up against walls because just her nature, she's just finds it hard to live at first in this environment. So there's many stories of her actually doing sort of a little bit defiant things, convincing a friend of hers to pick strawberries, for instance, from the garden and so forth. So she was not this perfect, unhuman person. She was certainly a typical person. I like to think of her as someone like in Little Women, Joe,
mm-hmm.
personality, or in Little House on the Prairie, Laura Ingalls, you know, an outgoing, full of life kind of person. And she breathes a lot of life, I think, into the convent and into her fellow sisters. You see her with a great sense of humor. And I think her humor gets her through a lot of the issues she has to come up against. And I love the story of her when she's going into the kitchen to fetch hot water. When she was working in the infirmary, she needed hot water for the patient, and she neglected to ask permission to get the water. And you have to ask permission for everything. And so the sister who was in charge of the kitchen at the time, you know, reprimands her and tells her to put that water back where she got it. Well, Bernadette's saying that the water came from the faucet. And when the mother assistant comes in and finds out what's going on and just sends Bernadette off to bring the hot water to the patient, Bernadette just couldn't help it. She laughs out loud leaving the kitchen because she's thinking what a funny concept about putting the water back up the faucet. You know, she's fun and just had that kind of sense of humor. But as fun as she was at like recreation times where she would sing and tease and tell jokes, her spirituality, though, was something she took very seriously. And because outside of recreation, or possibly in the infirmary, there was the rule of silence that was in force at the convent, she had a lot of time in that silence to really develop a deep and hidden holy life, trying to pattern her life after Jesus and Mary. And she had a great love for Mass and the Eucharist, and she used to love to hide herself under her veil, like pull her veil forward, like she used to pull that hood forward when she was in her peasant clothing in the public. She liked to have that solitude. She was also a wonderful natural caregiver. She served in the infirmary when she herself wasn't actually a patient in the infirmary, which was constantly, you know, on and off for her.
Mm-hmm.
She was tremendously wonderful with the patients, and she would deal with, you know, sores that were covered with worms and, you know, really stuff that would make many people get repulsed. And she had no fear of touching the sick, touching the dead, and she just had this wonderful natural giving of herself, always serving the poor, always serving the sick. And when she was a patient herself, she was always one who didn't complain. You know, they said they saw her at times with tears in her eyes because she was in such agony for a lot of life, but she never complained. You know, and you just see that, and she would take that all the way to her very last day. She was really heroic, not without fault, but what she did mostly was to master that self-will, to be obedient, to be humble, to be sincere, and really to to finally give everything over to Jesus at the end.
You're listening to Spirit Mornings with Bruce and Chris McGregor here at Spirit Catholic Radio, KVSS. And we're joined this morning by Elizabeth Ficicelli talking about St. Bernadette's Subaru.
One thing that I think would really help people kind of just image Bernadette is to remember that she was only 4'6". When you think about that, I have a dear friend of ours that many in the listening audience knows. Her name is Amy, and she is barely 5 feet tall. And yet when she walks into a room, it is just like this little dynamo powerhouse. And I imagine even St. Bernadette at 4'6", having to walk through crowds, having to try to, as you just, the story of carrying the water. I mean, it's just this little person doing this tremendous work.
Right. Very small in stature. And it's funny because she played this up a lot when people would, and she had that constant stream of visitors. Even though she was living a cloistered life, there were always people who received permission to see her, whether they were bishops and royalty and journalists and so forth. So she was constantly telling her story, like in the parlor, over and over and over. And or when new sisters would come and join the order and they would see her for the first time, you know, they have all these images of her in their mind, and this tiny little person emerges, and they're like, oh, that's all of you, you know?
Yes, right.
Yes, this is all of me. You know, she would kind of take it with a sense of humor. She never pretended to be bigger than she was, and I mean not only physically, but in every way. She just accepted, this is all I am, you know, and always talked about, you know, I am the most ignorant. This is why I was chosen. It was not anything having to do with that, something that I merited. This is completely my own. But she's very, very tiny, but just big in personality, big in humility, you know, big in the areas that, you know, these are the heroic virtues that the church looked at long after her death. And it was really hard for them, the people who play the devil's advocate, for instance, and try to find anything they can, reasons why we should not canonize this person. And it was really hard for them to come up with big, substantial things. It was little pride issues. That was what Bernadette always said. It was her pride. And it was her boiling nature, as she would refer to it, you know, that temper that would rise up, but she would always be able to subdue it. But again, you know, very human, but she just worked so hard at overcoming every fault that she could see that she had and accepting blame for things that weren't always her fault and taking all the, you know, all the things that her superiors were trying to do to keep her humility, because they were trying to help her, you know, develop her sanctity. So they were extra tough on her and critical of her, and she took that all in stride, and she set such a good example for us, you know, as Catholics, as Christians, when we're trying to follow Jesus in our own day-to-day life, you know, to be humble, to be simple, to be obedient, you know. We need these messages more than ever.
The thing is, Elizabeth, in Lourdes, Font of Faith, Hope, and Charity, your wonderful book on Lourdes and ultimately on Bernadette as well, you cite in the bibliography a book that I am very familiar with. We had the opportunity to talk to the author, Patricia McCarron, on A Holy Life, which really contains the writings of Bernadette. And what I really came away after reading that was how much she was like Thérèse. But then I had to remind myself, she was before Thérèse.
That's right. But they are. They're very much kindred spirits. They're very, very similar in personality. There's a lot of fundamental differences, you know, their economic status, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many similarities. But that Holy Life book that you're referencing, mm-hmm. excellent reference, and I would recommend it to your listeners, because I came upon it after I'd done the fundamental research for the book. That was one of the last things I read, and it was really like having an opportunity to sit down with Bernadette herself. And, you know, they say she never wrote any literary masterpieces, but these simple letters and journal entries, you know, really give us a peek into her life, and it really left me wanting more. I wish she had talked more about, we really think she had a spiritual agony at the end, a dark night of the soul in some way, but she really didn't let on a lot about it. She mentioned, you know, that the spiritual suffering was more terrifying than the physical. She never really elaborated it, either verbally or in her writings, and I kind of wish she had done that. But other than that, her writings that are revealed in this book really do give you the insight. She was still caring very much for her family back in Lourdes, because she was the oldest of the children, and that was the job of the eldest child, to be kind of watching over your siblings. So even from the convent, she was trying to make sure her siblings weren't getting caught up in just selling souvenirs at the grotto, you know, but doing something, living a holy life.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was chastising her siblings, you know, when they were going off the path. And so she had a great love for her family. She had a great attachment for her mother superior and sisters at the hospice, you know, in Lourdes, where she had served before she went to the convent. So these connections with the outer world. And she, of course, she lost her mom, her dad, and her beloved pastor. All these years that she was in the cloister, never had formal closure with any of them. So all these sufferings that she did, and they're revealed in her writings. You can see that just like that, she suffered, lived a human life, you know, in every way possible, and but still rose above all the struggles at the end.
I never appreciated either just how far Nevers was from Lourdes. It is way up there in the Pyrenees, isn't it?
Well, she Lourdes is in the Pyrenees. Nevers is about 2 hours or so more central France.
Okay.
But of course, back then, before, you know, because back then she was taking a train and then a stagecoach kind of thing. It was a journey. So it was, for her, leaving everything. But of course, you know, she was not going to ever return to home, family, or grotto once she made the decision to go into the cloistered life. So it could have been an hour away. It could have been 12 hours away. It was still that decision. But, yeah, it was a real cutting off of a lot in her life. That was another one of her sacrifices and sufferings. But she really came to the point when she made the decision to enter the cloistered religious life that she knew that her job at Lourdes had been complete, that what she was called to do in making these messages public and in telling the priests about the processionals and the chapel to be built, that she had done what she was told. And now that part of her life was over. Now she really needed to live out the messages in her own life, which is what all of us are called to do, is live out the messages of prayer, penance, and conversion that Lourdes called us to in our own life every day, whether we're, you know, a radio host or mother of four or, you know, wherever we are in life, that's where we have to live it every day.
Now, Elizabeth, you've written so beautifully books on First Communion, and especially for children. And when you write those books, and then, of course, we know that Bernadette had a suffering before the apparitions occurred in her attempt to be able to receive First Communion, but didn't have that opportunity for a good amount of time because she just was having trouble to learning her catechism.
Mm-hmm.
And I would imagine that reception, finally, of communion and that encounter with the sacraments became a very important part of her life.
It was her whole life goal at the point of the apparition. You know, she had even gone, I think we talked about this in the last interview, she had gone to Bartres for a time when, you know, the family sent her up there for her health reasons and that she would have a drier environment, more food, and she would be a nanny there for a while. But when she realized that she was not going to be able to get her First Holy Communion there because the lady of the house was so impatient with her and treated her, you know, just as an ignorant person who will never amount to anything. And when the priest of that town decided to go into a monastery, she realized that's a dead end. I can't continue my catechism here. So she comes back to Lourdes. She'll come back to poverty and that poor environment just to receive that sacrament because it's so important. And it isn't until almost towards the end of the apparitions, like after the 16th apparition, when Our Lady has revealed who she is. Now, the apparitions aren't formally approved at this point, but the priests are saying to themselves, if this is true, it's not proper that Bernadette hasn't received her First Holy Communion. Here she is 14, you know, a little over 14 years old, and children half her age are receiving. So that's when they work one-on-one. And so when she receives that Holy Communion, it is just like her dream come true. It is what she had desired so much. And so that's spiritually one of the things that we see Lourdes does, of course, as an authentic Marian apparition, brings us to Christ.
Mm-hmm.
It brings us to Christ in the Eucharist, in confession. And Lourdes does exactly that for Bernadette. She'll make her first confession when she goes to the priest to first tell about the apparitions and her struggle of wanting to return to the grotto but not to disobey her parents. And then it will bring her to Eucharist. And this is what we're all called again to emulate what Bernadette did. But yes, it was her greatest joy. In fact, when she sees the lady for the last time, and comments that the lady never looked more beautiful, some theologians speculate it was now because she already was receiving Holy Communion.
Mm.
She was seeing the Blessed Mother with new eyes and everything. So, but yeah, it would always be a sacrament that would remain dear to her. There, you know, some of the sisters would testify later after her death and, you know, in the process of canonization, how she would just glow, her face would glow after receiving Holy Communion, and she would truly be elevated, you know, spiritually, that she just became unaware of everything going on around her. She was truly in rapture after receiving Holy Communion. So it was a definite sacrament that meant a tremendous amount to her entire life.
In Lourdes, in particular, during this Jubilee year, they have pilgrim stations set up when you go there to be able to really experience the fullness of the indulgence that's there, that you stop at these different locations, kind of you do like a stations for Bernadette. And one of those stops is the place where she received her first Holy Communion, because it's such an important part of the story.
Right. It's an opportunity to enable you to walk in the footsteps of Bernadette. So you'll see where she's baptized and where she received Holy Communion. You'll see where she was born. And, you know, so it's just this opportunity to kind of trace her steps and see a little bit what life was like. But, yeah, all these very important steps along the way. And thank goodness they're preserved for us still to this day. And, of course, the grotto, as always, remains the heart of everything of that sanctuary. And you'll see when you do your pilgrimage, it's such a spiritual place where prayers are definitely heard in a very powerful way, and it's just something you really have to experience. It's just a wonderful experience.
Elizabeth, you talk about the grotto and the healings in your book, not only physically but spiritually. I can't help but feel sometimes with Bernadette, she had such a great love for Our Lady and for the Eucharist. Her suffering physically, though, was so acute, especially towards the end. You wonder, could she not go back to the grotto? Was this water not for her, too?
Right, and, you know, certainly the sisters offered her the water, and she said, you know, the water is not for me. You know, she realized that, again, she could embrace this physical suffering because she could offer it up. It was always a gift. You know, it's interesting, her final agony, say the last 6 to 8 months of her life, she becomes in a place where she is no longer able to serve, and this for Bernadette is her worst nightmare. Be useless, and because she did love so much to give of herself and to truly serve others. So she becomes completely useless. She's no longer able to walk. The sisters have to carry her to Mass, literally. She hates to be the burden, but she also never allows herself to sink into self-absorbed suffering. She uses it as a gift. She always turns it around as a gift, and you kind of see her going into this, and her physical agony, you know, that she had a knee that was ravaged by the bone cancer. She has the infected lungs. She can't breathe at night. She can't move without being in agony. She's trying not to keep the other patients up at night. And again, she's trying to offer all this up. And she'll even get to the point where, like I said, about the spiritual agonies and so forth. But she'll handle all this with such joy still. And this is the thing about Bernadette. She is a joyful saint. And she will handle this. She says a famous quote at the end. She's in her little hospital bed, which is draped by a white curtain. She refers to it as her little white chapel. And she had had for many months all these little holy cards and religious items pinned all over the curtains. And she has at the very, very end, the sisters take everything down off of those curtains. And all she's left is holding the crucifix of Jesus in her hands. And she was quoted as saying, "I'm happier with my crucifix on my bed of pain than a queen on her throne." Mm. At the end, all she has left is Jesus. And she really hangs in there, and is such a model, such a role for all of us, but never loses that sense of joy and anticipation. And I think that's just the lesson that we can learn from Bernadette, is that, you know, when the lady had said to her in the third apparition, "I cannot promise you happiness in this world, but in the other," the more recent translations say in the next world, because people were assuming that the lady meant heaven, that don't count on happiness here, and that was pretty evident in Bernadette's life. As I said in the beginning, she had a very difficult life, and yet Bernadette did find happiness in it, and she will find happiness in all these struggles, and then we're all guaranteed that true happiness in heaven, but we're asked to live it now, here on earth, you know, it's not just to wait for heaven, and so she opens that path for all of us, and living in the spiritual world while you're still in the material world, and being joyful in all those experiences. We're all invited to take that same path. So she offers so much in her spirituality beyond the apparition. You know, of course, those are important for us as well, but her life and her role after those apparitions is so, so key, and we can learn so much from it.
Well, and that's what really the reason for her canonization. It isn't necessarily the apparitions at Lourdes. It was how the heroic virtue of her life afterwards.
Exactly, and that's what the Church looks at, you know, because, again, she was, yes, highly favored by God to receive those apparitions, but it's a great responsibility to have that and to live that out. And we saw, like with La Salette, mm-hmm. Mary, the boy and the girl, who afterwards didn't live such a holy life, and there was some scandal even involved with them.
Right.
And so it's not a guarantee that because you are favored to have a vision or a locution that this is guaranteeing your sainthood. We are all fighting every day for our salvation, and certainly Bernadette and I like to think of her as the seed in Scripture that falls to the ground and dies in order to bear new life, because when Bernadette crawled on that muddy ground and you know, was trying to dig for the spring that the lady was asking her to, and she's in this mud and she's washing her face with this muddy water and just debasing herself in this process, she dies to herself in that kind of process. But look what new life came out of that. You have a new life of cures and conversions that 150 years later are still happening. So, you know, all this thing, and I also like to use that analogy of Bernadette as the seed that dies to herself, because she, as a child, grew up in a flour mill, and, you know, that where she saw the grain being ground, and in fact, one of her last statements she made in her sufferings was, "I have been ground in the mill like a grain of wheat," and she was. That look at the new life that she brought forward.
Elizabeth, as we talk about her life and just that, again, that heroic virtue that she so beautifully demonstrated and the grace that she received to be able to do that, you almost have to have, at least as a footnote, the extraordinary occurrence after her death. And for many people, when they first encounter Bernadette, it's either because of the apparitions at Lourdes or it's because her body is incorrupt. And when we talked about incorrupt bodies, she's probably one of the most beautiful examples of having been preserved in this state. And yet, again, this is not why she's a saint, is because her body has not suffered this corruption, but it is an extraordinary occurrence.
It is, and it's such a gift that God favors certain individuals with this blessing. And I think the blessing, of course, is for us, you know, because here is our tangible witness that these men and women and children lived. And they're still here among us. I mean, they're certainly our friends in heaven and are there at our beck and call the moment we ask for it. But their bodies, in some cases, are still here. So we can gaze upon them, so we can pray reverently in front of them and ask for their intercession. And I think that you told me in the last interview that you will have a chance to go to Nevers and see her body.
Yep, that's right.
That's going to be an awesome experience.
What I found was I almost kind of wanted to hit myself in the head a little bit afterwards, because again, I heard so much about her, the apparitions, and then of course the fact that her body is incorrupt, that when I started delving into her life, I really began to see that those things are on the peripheral. It's the life of this young woman and how she conducted it. It is truly a theology book, her life story, for so many of us to know and come, and how we can live out just that call to Christian service and to love others.
Absolutely. And she's an approachable saint, just like Therese is an approachable saint. And, you know, again, with her being a 14-year-old at the time of the apparitions, she is a magnet for young people. You know, they can see themselves as having an important role in this world and a feeling of being needed and an instrument of God's grace, just like everyone else. And so she just offers a message for so many people. Even people not of the Catholic faith, I think, can relate to her and admire her and be interested in learning more about her. So hopefully she'll be one of the doorways we have to the great community of saints, because there's such a wealth and such a treasure, and we can learn something from every single one of them. But I'm so pleased that we are living in this 150th anniversary year, and we're able to write books and video shows and promote this, because there's so many Americans, I think, that really don't know a lot about apparitions, but about this one in particular. And it is a great sign of Catholicism, where it's alive and vibrant, and it's a way to apply it in your own life and live a more holy life, a more rewarding life. So it's just an endless treasure.
If you don't mind me suggesting, Elizabeth, if you ever get the opportunity to write more about France of that period, and what is it about these little French people? When you talk about John Vianney, I mean, Therese, Bernadette, Catherine Labre. What was happening here with these little people who have such huge messages for us today?
You know, I think that's a good question, and I think France, you know, it used to be the eldest daughter of the church. It is a place that has really spawned all these great people, saints and mystics and visionaries and popes I think France has always had a very special place in our Lord's heart and in Our Lady's heart, because he certainly sent his mother so many times there to wake people up and try to, and it's been a country that's been in such turbulence, it remains in turbulence, and it does so because it keeps forgetting its roots. And it's like a microcosm for the rest of the world. You know, when we forget our roots, when we turn to secularism and politics and military, and we forget our roots in God, you know, this is where we invite trouble into our lives. We're seeing this in America. So I think France is that lesson for us, and yet God repeatedly, you know, blesses that nation with these great, amazing people that the rest of us certainly are benefiting from. But, I do pray for the people in France, and that they will rediscover that wonderful Christian heritage that they have, and the blessings that God's been with them so much in the different centuries. But particularly, it's like about a 100-year period where these amazing people came forth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hopefully we can continue to learn from it, I guess, is the main point.
Well, I'm hoping you'll start writing about the others as well, because you have a beautiful way of breaking it open, not only of the historical dimensions, but what it means for us spiritually today.
Well, I may. Right now I'm discerning, I think I'm being called to do something on Guadalupe, which will be very interesting, because I'm in the same place as I was with Lourdes when I was asked to do that. I had not been there. I didn't know anything beyond the basic story, and I'm sort of that same way with Guadalupe, but I'm already seeing a bunch of different angles to go off on a book with that. So pray for me, because I'm always discerning what I'm supposed to do next, and God will reveal it when he's ready.
Well, I'll certainly do that if it's for Our Lady of Guadalupe. You have my prayers every day.
Okay, terrific.
Well, Elizabeth Ficicelli, you've been with us this morning. And again, Elizabeth, this has been a true delight. We appreciate your talking about Bernadette Soubirous. And we look forward to, I'm certain, another conversation or two before Chris leaves on her pilgrimage in October. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time.
All right. God bless all of you.